We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and we've been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that feature some of our most interesting guests, and we think touch on topics that are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. In this installment of what we're calling the Deep Archives, we have two interviews that look at the way that technology changes us and the way we live and how we experience something as basic as time. Howard Rheingold has been writing about computers, the internet, and virtual communities since the early 1980s. He calls himself a critical friend of technology and has long been known as a community-based hacker, activist, and theorist. He was one of the founders of Hotwired, the first commercial web magazine, and also was editor-in-chief of the Millennium Whole Earth Catalog. His book, Tools for Thought, first published in 1985, profiled many of the key figures in the development of the computer. An updated edition was published in 2000, and in June of that year, Howard Rheingold was a guest on the show, and he talked with our Jack Brighton. Rheingold said that while computers had become embedded in our daily lives, and that happened in the early 80s, that at that time, personal computers, they were just much less powerful than they are today, and it really wasn't all that clear what you would do with one.
It's hard to convey the way the pace of change has sort of created this self-erasing phenomenon in which we forget what life was like even 5 or 10 years ago.
Right.
In general, we don't seem to have a good way of talking about and studying and looking at the big picture, the way our technologies are affecting our minds and our personal relationships and our society. On the other hand, I think this is another example of that kind of historical amnesia that technological change has brought upon us. I guess I'm old enough now to talk about the olden days, typewriters. Mm-hmm. I had a typewriter. As a writer, I spent the first 10 years of my career retyping a page every time I needed to move a paragraph around. There were times when I cut pages apart with a knife and use tape to tape them back together again. When I discovered word processing, it wasn't just that it saved typing. It enabled me to think in a new way. It enabled me to try a lot of things. When I had to retype every page, I really didn't have the luxury of trying a lot of things, not if I was ever going to get an article finished. So I think, as Engelbart pointed out, when you augment a lower-level capability in your hierarchy of capabilities, the ability to move sentences around, you also augment higher-level capabilities, the ability to compose things better. So I think we don't really understand now that we are able to, just to pick one thing, compose documents in ways that just were not possible 20 years ago. The same thing goes for email and computer graphics and the web. People do things every day, ordinary people, not necessarily highly technical people, that just weren't possible before. Things on an organizational level or on a social level or on an intellectual level that we take for granted. I think, in a sense, this must be a process that the human civilization has been going through for quite a while. You know, there was a day when not very many people were literate, and the things you could do by reading and writing were limited to just a few people. And the printing press enabled entire populations to be literate, to have new capabilities. So I think we've been upgrading our capabilities and not having a very good understanding of those changes for quite a while.
The issue of literacy and computers seems extremely important, Howard, especially as we talk about the digital divide and how people are either given access to the tools or the knowledge of how to use those tools and maybe shut out of those activities. And I'm wondering what you think about that. What is computer literacy? What does it consist of? I mean, what do the majority of people need to know? And do we even know that yet?
Well, first of all, I think you need to talk about people having the fundamental, the basics of life. If you can't pay for a roof over your head and
sure.
you can't feed your family, then the rest of it is somewhat moot. Although, if you have the basics, I think it's quite obvious to most people that you need to learn how to read and write in order to make it in our society. Increasingly, and I don't think we're ever going to go back from this, you need to know more than how to read and write. You need to understand how to interact with this technological infrastructure. Now, what we know as a personal computer today is changing, I think, somewhat rapidly, and may diffuse into all kinds of devices, from telephones to appliances. But the idea that you can issue commands to a computer and have the computer perform work for you, and that there are some fairly simple applications that enable you to use this, I think that's a fundamental kind of literacy. And I think important part of it is not learning how to use a particular computer program, or certainly not how to program computers, but to understand how to sit in front of one of these devices and interact with it and learn how to use it. There's a certain amount of self-teaching that's involved with any computer technology. So I think, yes, it's an important new literacy. I don't think our public school system is well equipped to teach it. Teachers aren't necessarily well equipped to understand how to teach it. They haven't been trained to do so. The technologies themselves need to be maintained. You just can't buy a computer and an internet connection and plop it down in a classroom and expect that to operate trouble-free forever without someone maintaining it. There are a whole lot of social questions around how we as a society are going to make access to computer literacy available. But I think that there's little question that it's an important survival tool for the future.
Mm-hmm. I also wonder if the demands of computer literacy distract from the longer-term project to improve text literacy, or, you know, I suppose it can be used as tools in that endeavor. But, you know, clearly there are a lot of people at the top end of the scale who know a lot about computers and how to use them, and rushing ahead further, pushing the envelope when we have a lot of very basic things we still need to do for the children and people living today.
Well, boy, that's a complicated story.
Yeah.
Somewhat of a rat hole. Public education is a major issue and problem in the U.S. today, and it complicates it when you add technology to it.
Right.
First of all, some schools are in trouble because there is not enough money devoted to those schools to fix the toilets and to have enough desks for students and have enough teachers for the students. And certainly those fundamentals must come before technology. And I don't think that we're going to be able to magically solve those problems. People are going to have to make some hard decisions about that. They're going to have to figure out a way to spend more money, mostly, and to spend it more efficiently on the public school system. There does seem to be a certain amount of magical thinking surrounding computers and the internet. If we just put computers and internet connections in classrooms, that would somehow magically solve these problems. And clearly, to my way of thinking, not only is that not right, but it's extremely counterproductive. It may, in fact, impede the development of a comprehensive literacy that includes technology literacy. 15 years ago, when personal computers were first available, there was similar magical thinking. Let's put computers in classrooms. Well, the computers were kind of puny. Teachers didn't understand how to use them. There wasn't effective software for education. And that computer revolution in the early and mid-1980s failed, and a lot of those computers are being used as doorstops or just got thrown out. I think we need to be careful about, and I think we're seeing it becoming a political issue, that adding internet to classrooms without thoroughly thinking out the issues of teacher training and maintaining the network and upgrading it and how to use it as an integrated part of the curriculum, it's simply going to be a disaster. It's going to set things back. So we've got a complicated issue of public education in our country, and we've got another complicated issue. How do you bring computers and internet into classrooms? And we're just throwing them both together without a great deal of forethought, and I fear that there will be a disaster coming out of it.
Let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. I want to go back to your comment, which I did not understand, about the connection with public schools and putting internet connections in them. You suggested somehow that this had the potential for a disaster, and that phrase raised more questions than I can answer. And it answered. I'm going to hang up, but if you can make some comment about in what manner of speaking can you see this technology interacting with the public school system in a disastrous fashion or a bad fashion. I just didn't understand what you were talking about. Thanks.
Sure. Good question. First of all, let me compare this to the computer revolution of the 1980s. It was a disaster and set back the idea that computer technology has a place in education. It was a disaster because the computers were inadequate, the software was inadequate. People thought that putting computers in classrooms would do the trick, whereas in fact there was a lot of teacher training and education involved. There's a need for additional funds for maintenance of the technology. There's a whole infrastructure besides just the box that you can see on the desktop that makes it, a computer a useful device in education. Now, we're seeing people saying, we need to wire up all our classrooms. Well, you've got teachers out there who are already working their 40-hour weeks and more. They're not paid all that well, and they spend some of their own money to buy art supplies because there is no tax money for things like art supplies anymore. Many of those teachers are computer literate, and many of them are not. Now, are we going to provide computers and internet access and money for teacher training, or are we going to expect them to have to scramble to catch up in what's left of their spare time? Then there's maintenance. Anybody who has ever maintained a computer network of the simplest kind will tell you that you don't just put the pipeline in, connect a box to it, and go away. You need to have a system administrator who's there to maintain the network because it will go down in mysterious ways. Well, if that is not budgeted in, then either the one teacher who understands how to do things is going to have added unpaid work added to his or her day, or the whole thing will go down and people will dismiss the idea of technology in the classroom as unworkable. So there's a whole framework, I believe, for making technology in the classroom useful. It includes not just money for computers and internet connections, which seems to be where most of the political promises are going, but money and time for teacher training, money to pay people to administer the network and to maintain it. And I think equally importantly, we need to look at the best practices of those teachers who know how to use the technology in a way that integrates it with the curriculum and doesn't make it just a separate item to add and compete with the reading, writing, and arithmetic that goes on in the classroom. So if you integrate this training and support and understanding how to use technology in the curriculum and can find a way to pay the price for that, I think that it could be a tremendous addition to public education. If you don't, I think it's going to be a waste of money. People are going to wonder why education didn't get better. Teachers are going to be overworked and fed up. Students are going to be disappointed, and taxpayers are going to be angry. And that's the disaster I was talking about. I think the point is that education is a process that requires skilled professionals, specialists, teachers, and that individual attention, especially with young children, for whom learning is a social process, not just a matter of getting some facts into their head, is essential to education. There is a saying, I think it's attributed to John Keats, I may be wrong about the attribution, but the phrase is, education is an igniting, not a pouring. I think that a lot of visions of technology in education is as a big funnel or a big pipeline for inexpensively pouring facts into students' heads. What teachers do is they ignite students' imagination and their desire to learn. So I think whether you're talking about books or computers, these are media, they're tools, they need to be used effectively by skilled professionals, and I don't think we're ever going to do away with teachers, particularly in the younger grades.
I want to ask you to talk a bit about the internet and the public sphere. I found an article on your website where I see you're a Jürgen Habermas fan, and talking about how citizens can use these tools to strengthen the public sphere. You've been involved in a lot of work building virtual communities, and I wonder if you can talk a bit about what it takes to create that kind of environment.
Okay. Maybe I think I ought to talk just for a minute about what this phrase, the public sphere, means.
Sure.
It sounds a little fancy, and in fact, it is a subject of study by professors, but it's something that's profoundly fundamental to a democratic society. Democracy is not just for voting for the people who represent you. Democracy is about citizens governing ourselves. It's about citizens understanding issues, discussing those issues with each other, debating them, and then voting. Now, the public sphere is a place that's neither sponsored by the government nor by private enterprise. It's where people get together to talk about things. They used to do it in the town square or the tavern. The American Revolution was largely planned in coffee houses, public places where people can gather as citizens to discuss the issues that concern us. That's the public sphere. Now, of course, communication is an important part of the public sphere, and mass communication is a powerful force. The newspaper and the printed broadside were obviously important in the American Revolution and the Civil War. We have seen, of course, in the age of mass media, the consolidation of ownership. Where we used to have thousands of little newspapers, we now have two or three huge chains. We've also seen the enormous power of broadcast media, such as we're using now. A few people can broadcast information to millions of people. In the age of radio and television, we've become, to some degree, a society of passive consumers of media. We don't really make that much of our own media until the internet came along, and again, gave us that many-to-many capabilities. So there are thousands of political manifestos, hundreds of thousands of political manifestos. There are chat rooms and bulletin board systems of better and worse degrees of useful dialogue, but citizens now have the capability of publishing and debating with each other in a way that we have not had since the dawn of the age of mass media. So my question is, with all of the attention on the dot-coms and the billions of dollars being made and the debates about pornography, are we losing track of what may be an important opportunity, which is for the citizens of democratic nations to use these media to learn how to talk with each other and inform each other about issues? There are lots and lots and lots of sites on the Internet that are trying to inform people and give people an opportunity to communicate with each other. I've been involved with virtual communities. One of my books, which is also going to be reissued by MIT Press, by the way, it's called The Virtual Community. And in fact, the full text of that book, even though it's 8 years old, is on my website at reingold.com. I put it on my website, competing with my own sales of books, because I felt it was important in the age of a lot of hype and misinformation to get the notion out to people that the Internet is used by people for social communication. And part of that social communication has to do with our role as citizens. I think most people who have not been online or who are only recently online have a somewhat skewed idea of what online communication is about, because there are an awful lot of chat rooms that are just kind of smut, and there are a lot of bulletin board systems where people flame and insult each other. But if you look for them, you will find places where people who ordinarily might not have talked because of their socioeconomic or political differences having debates about issues. And I think that is fundamentally extremely important to democracy, and it's important that we keep that public sphere alive on the Internet as the medium matures.
I guess I want to sort of throw this at you. The Internet has begun to look to many people like another consumer medium, something like interactive television with commercials tailored to individual interests, rather than the community-building or mind-augmenting technology that its creators envisioned. What do you think about this? Are you concerned about the way the web in particular has evolved? I mean, is there room enough on the Internet for both hyper-commercialism and the free exercise of collective intelligence or something like that?
Well, there's certainly room on it. The fact that Microsoft or Yahoo or AOL are amassing billions of dollars using the Internet doesn't stop you or me from putting our website up. And I think that's really the great fundamental power shift that the Internet represents, is what's called the many-to-many capacity. Every desktop, every computer connected to the Internet is now a printing press and a broadcasting station, a place of assembly, and a marketplace. Now, I'm never going to get as rich as Bill Gates, and the little mom-and-pop website is never going to be Yahoo. But Yahoo and Microsoft don't prevent the mom-and-pop websites from going up. So I think we see parallel evolutions. We see public and small individual private enterprises thriving, and we see massive corporate, near-monopoly, cartel-like organizations thriving. There is, of course, the question of, is a government or a corporate cartel going to be able to control the Internet and prevent people from freely expressing or freely using this resource? And it's kind of hard right now to see how that could happen. But I think a greater concern is something of a concern over atmosphere. You know, in 1994, people laughed at the idea that you could make money on the Internet. The web became attractive to commercial enterprises because a million people put up websites because they thought they were useful or fun or entertaining things to do, and they wanted to, A, share them with the world, and B, show themselves off. That kind of cooperative, collaborative, public, collective creativity was a tremendous explosion of the capabilities of the Internet and really set the stage for the dot-com era. But I fear that many people now think that if you're not a dot-com and you're not in it for the money, you're out of it. You're a fool. You're an amateur. And in fact, we may lose a lot of the capability of further revolutions if people don't understand that it's not all about going public and making a jillion dollars.
And that's Howard Rheingold. He was a guest on this show in June of 2000. He talked with Jack Brighton. In the years since, Howard Rheingold has continued to write about computers, virtual communities, and social media, and you can sample his recent work by going to his website, which is rheingold.com. This year, our program, Focus, turned 30, and to celebrate that fact, we have dug into our tape collection looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the second part of the show today, we have another writer known for exploring the relationship between technology, society, and the environment, Jeremy Rifkin. In his books, he's taken on a range of subjects, including biotechnology, the potential for a hydrogen-based economy, and the hazards of hypercapitalism. When he was guest on this show back in 1987, we talked about his book, Time Wars. In that book, he argues that to know a people is to know the time values they live by. Our time values, he says, are characterized by efficiency and speed. We think faster is better, but as he explains, it wasn't always that way.
I tried to point out in Time Wars how new our time orientation is. There was no such thing as an hour as a standardized unit until the 1300s. It did not exist. The Benedictines came up with the hour as a standard unit in the monasteries. They also invented the mechanical clock, and they invented another innovation, which you and I have been burdened by over the years, and it's called the schedule. They actually created the concept of a schedule. There was no such thing as a schedule before then, so you can blame the Benedictines for your appointment calendars. But now, the minute didn't originate until the 1600s in terms of the popular culture, and the second hand originated in medicine, scientific research, and navigation in the 1700s. Now, we have the nanosecond. That's the newest frame of reference. In a nanosecond is 1/1,000,000,000 of a second. So now in computer time, which is a new revolutionary time orientation, we now are organizing time below the realm of participatory experience. It is impossible to experience a nanosecond. So what will happen when our children and their children grow up in a world where time is so segmented into such small units that they will not be able to experience it, but only treat it as an abstract conception? So time has varied quite a bit. Let me say one more thing about this. You know, it's ironic that I think my opening paragraph of Time Wars sums up the feeling of most people. It's ironic that we in Western society have spent decades, maybe a century, in trying to develop labor-saving, time-saving technologies. We've been obsessed with it. Yet we feel we have less time than any other culture in history. Now, that's the final joke that we've played on ourselves. And what I'm suggesting in Time Wars is that we're about to see time emerge as a major intellectual frontier and as a major social issue, comparable to what happened with spatial politics in the 1960s and 70s. Remember, in the 1960s, the major spatial myth was bigger is better. It was an unchallenged myth about spatial scale. Then a heresy took hold. Small is beautiful. The right wing attacked big government. The left wing attacked big business. Society in general attacked the large bureaucratic scale of institutions. And throughout the political spectrum, the idea of scale became very important in politics and in our intellectual discussions. What I'm suggesting in Time Wars is that we are now going to move into temporal politics as well as spatial politics. The major time myth of our age is faster is better. Hyper-efficiency and speed are unchallenged. What I'm suggesting is that we are going to see a movement emerge intellectually and politically over the coming decade, espousing the idea that slow is humane. And I think that that is going to have poignant impact on our intellectual community and on our politics over the coming decade or two.
I'm interested in having you talk about this this sort of dislocation between people's internal sense of time and the sense of time or the schedules that are imposed on them. You talk about it's interesting the section of developing of the clock, about the fact that the first clocks didn't even have hands.
That's right.
They just had bells or chimes that would chime the hour. And that very quickly, cities decided, you know, they looked at the things that the Benedictines were doing and were thinking, now this would be very convenient for keeping things running on schedule and getting people up and getting them to work. And you go on in a later place to make the statement that imposition of culturally derived temporal norms is the key socializing tool, and it certainly is. And again, a little bit later, you talk about the fact that children, as they grow up, are trained to live in two time worlds at once, the biological one that exists in them and the social one that is imposed on them, and that somehow these two worlds are being driven further and further apart.
That's right. We have always lived in two time worlds. Our biological time world is fixed. The planet has its own rhythm. It has its own pulse. And our internal biology of all living things are made up of myriad biological clocks that are entrained to move in synchronicity and to be paced with the solar day or the lunar month or the circannual or seasonal rhythms. And there's a section in Time Wars on chronobiology. We are learning that we have tremendous number of internal clocks that are entrained to the actual rhythms of this planet. Yet our social time is imposed artificially on these biological and natural rhythms. Now, for most of history, our social time was very closely attuned to our biological time and the time of the planet. Up until the modern age, social time was compatible with the seasons, the solar day, the monthly rhythms, etc. We broke from that about 200 years ago with the development of the steam engine, the widespread use of the clock, and then telecommunications, etc. Remember that the whole idea of speed was not even an issue until 200 years ago. Now, in the last 200 years, speed has become crucial, and our social time is so sped up in the nanosecond culture and now with the computer being introduced that it bears no resemblance to our biological rhythms. So we find our society increasingly hyped up to the point of temporal gridlock. The pace of the society is increasing exponentially, and increased pace means increased impatience, less tolerance, inability to savor an experience, stress produced by our biological rhythms being overtaxed by the social demands on our personal and public lives. And so what I'm trying to suggest in Time Wars is a major confrontation, a crisis, between social time and the ecological or environmental time that our bodies are made for. And that's creating a tremendous amount of alienation in the culture and stress.
Yeah. Is that, you know, the subtitle of the book, which I did not mention, is The Primary Conflict in Human History. Is that the conflict that you're talking about?
That's the contemporary conflict. If you take a look, it is interesting through history. The great revolutionary changes in social orientation in history have been changes in time orientation. Now, you know, we're used to thinking of major changes as changes in the means of production, material changes, which are very essential. But what we have ignored is that along with those changes in material means or resource means, The great changes in history could not have taken place without revolutionary transformations in time consciousness. Let me give you an example. In the movement from the medieval to the industrial age, it would have been impossible to have produced a society that could deal with industrial production rhythms without producing first a consciousness that saw time as external, abstract, quantitative, efficient, and fast-paced. And the big battle between the medieval church and the emerging bourgeoisie was as much over time as it was over resources and territory. The church said, time belongs to God. You can't buy it. You can't sell it. Remember the laws that's against usury and charging interest. And the reason they said you could not exploit time for profit or for interest is that you cannot use something that doesn't belong to you. Only God owns time. The bourgeoisie and the merchants said, no, time is money. We ought to be able to invest money and use time to charge interest, to buy cheap, to sell dear. And so there was a tremendous confrontation over the value of time. The church thought it was something that prepared you for the next kingdom. The bourgeoisie and the merchants thought time was money and an exploitable medium. Eventually, the merchants won out and created a new time frame. But even with that, the agricultural workers were very, very resistant toward being indoctrinated into the industrial time frame. Getting the agricultural workers to accept punctuality, to be at the job at the same time every day, to come and go with bells and clocks. This was a total new orientation, and for several generations, workers rebelled. If you were looking at this period of history anthropologically, and you were to ask what the biggest single change in cultural and social and political orientation has been in the last 200 years, it's been the ascendancy of an obscure value called efficiency, which is now the prime value orientation that we use to organize the entire civilization. Efficiency meaning the speeding up the delivery of something, maximizing the output with the minimum labor, energy, and capital in the process. That is a new value. In other cultures, even now today in the third world, it's difficult for them to even understand the concept of efficiency because it is at odds with their traditional time orientations.
You talk often in the book about the computer and the way it has changed society, and you were just talking about our obsession with efficiency. You talk about the computer as the ultimate technological expression of that obsession with efficiency, and about the way that it has been used to change things. One way that's, again, it's something that people may not really be conscious of unless they intimately work with the machine in this way, is the way that it has just sped everything up. It's used to speed up work. It's even been used to speed up speech. It's sort of an accelerated version of the that clock in the tower or the whistle that blows at certain times of the day, only it's much, much faster. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah. What I'm trying to say in Time Wars is that we have a new time orientation here. The clock and schedule is now being subsumed by the computer and the program. You know, when I was growing up, I don't know how old you are. I'm 42. When I was growing up, we talked about scheduling our future activities. Now our children talk about programming them. The computer is starting to take its place alongside the clock and the schedule. And its whole purpose was to make things more efficient. The computer is designed to, quote, process information, unquote, or manage activities in a more efficient manner. So it's what has happened is that it has done what it's intended to do. It's increased the flow of activities, increased the speed at which we do things, and the efficiency. But now we're paying for that. Increased pace means increased impatience. And what we become increasingly intolerant of in a nanosecond, computer culture, is human relations. Because human beings' response time is basically measured in terms of our longstanding biological clocks. We engage with each other
in a time frame that's not very much different than our ancestors 100 years ago. Yet our activities and our management of activities are speeding by in nanosecond time frames. Let me give you some examples. NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Health and Safety, issued a study back in 81 saying that computer workers, people working in the computer-type orientation or computer jobs, suffer higher stress levels than any other worker, including air traffic controllers. And what Office of Technology Assessment just put out a report since I wrote Time Wars, and they said millions of workers are being monitored by computers to check every nuance of their time orientation performance to make sure they don't slack off at the job. For example, you go to a grocery store. Mm-hmm. The cash register person doesn't have time to talk with you anymore because she is monitored on how fast she puts every product over that electronic grid. If she slows down in many of the grocery chains, she can be penalized, so she doesn't take the time to talk. They're finding therapy groups are emerging among people who live with computer workers and people who work heavily in the computer industry. Now, we're talking extremes here. We're not talking the average computer person, but rather the compulsive person or the person who is totally oriented to a computer work world. They find that these workers oftentimes are not able to handle slower discourse. They want people to talk efficiently, no tangents, no associative thinking, get the information out and do it fast. Some computer workers have screens that if you don't answer the data on the screen in 17 seconds, the data disappears and you have to start from scratch and you're penalized at the workplace. It goes on and on. The point here is that we are now creating a culture where our children are growing up in a nanosecond time frame. They are unable to experience the slower time frame of social discourse and natural events. We're getting further away from our own environmental choreography.
Let me ask you this question. In you're talking about changing our time orientation. You say that we're at a point or drawing to a point where we're facing an important change or an opportunity for change. And you were talking about changing time orientation. Some people would look at it and say what you're doing is you're trying to pull us back. You're trying to go back to an earlier way of thinking. And I wonder whether you're really not whether what you're really talking about is in fact a forward kind of movement. That it is an evolution rather than a retro kind of activity.
Yeah, I'm saying that we need to develop a much more sophisticated concept of time in the future. We need to really assess our biological clocks and the physical time of the planet much more cogently, and then develop a ecological time orientation for society that's compatible with sustaining the natural resource base we live in, and that's congenial with human interaction. What I'm asking for, it requires a tremendous leap ahead in terms of consciousness. We're not going to go back to a pastoral state or a pre-conscious hunter-gatherer existence in terms of time orientation. We can, however, as I say in the last section of Time Wars, make a decision to develop a super aware concept of time and an ecological time orientation and develop our science, our technology, our private lives, our economic philosophy, and our public policy so that it is compatible with that ecological time orientation. If we continue along the hyper-efficient speed route, it's an addiction that has no end. The faster we try and catch up by developing time-saving technologies, the more the activity flow increases and the more we're left behind. There is no way to catch up, no matter how many microwave ovens you have, because all of these technologies increase the flow of activity, and we become increasingly unable to keep pace with the temporal gridlock in front of us. And everyone listening in most people, I think, if you ask them, would say they feel they have less time available now than they had even 5 years ago, even though they have many more time-saving devices.
Yeah.
If you go to a third-world culture, the first thing people do is they get impatient. People say are frustrated. We say they're on manana time. We can't get anything done quickly. Really, what they're on is seasonal time, organic and agricultural time. And generally, after you spend a few months in another culture, you start to find that you have all the time in the world because you develop the time orientation that's cued toward the environment and not toward the artificiality of electronic devices.
We just have about 5 minutes left. I'm a slave to the clock here on this program, so that's something I can't dodge. But something that I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about was how time is political.
Yes.
And you talk about democratization of time. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at it historically, one of the themes in Time Wars is the control of time in history. Those who control the time frame of a society control the social orientation. Let me give you an example. During the French Revolution, the New Republic tried to eliminate the calendar because the Christian calendar, the church controlled the time orientation of French citizens by the calendar with all the holy days and feast days and they controlled how people use their time. The French revolutionaries tried to eliminate it by setting up the new French calendar. They, instead of AD, BC, they had year one, the year of the revolution. The weeks were subdivided into decimals and the hours. They eliminated all the holy days, and they put in a handful of holidays like loyalty to the state day or conjugal fidelity day. This is right out of 1984. The French Republic rebelled, mainly because the new French calendar substituted some 115 holidays with only 30 or 40 of their own. But again, it was an example of what happens when a culture is stripped away of the old orientation, the church's orientation on time, and replaced with a radical new time orientation so those in power could control the unfolding of events. We're now finding in studies on time that there's time hierarchies in culture. In Time Wars, I had a sociological survey done by a gentleman years ago where they found that those who are from the poorer classes economically are also from the time ghettos. Those who are on the bottom of the time scale are also on the bottom of the economic scale. Those are the people who are not tutored in the past. They have no historical tutoring, and they're not used to delaying gratifications. They don't have the resources to allow them to plan ahead. They're stuck in an ever-present temporal ghetto. They don't delay gratification for the future because they have little resources, and they're unable to conjure up the historical skills they need. Those on the top of the time hierarchy, however, are the people who control both the history of the culture and control and predict its futures. And this has been true all the way back to the beginning of time. The palace priests in the Sumerian civilization, they could predict the future because they had an understanding of astronomy. And they could predict when the floodwaters would come and how the seasons would change. And everybody was enamored with their ability to control and predict future time segments. Today, those who are on top are the people who program the future and the scientists who predict outcomes before they materialize. And much of society is at the bottom of the time ladder, and so it's a quite an interesting political context.
And now, though, just to wrap up, you talk about some emerging political constituencies that have a different time orientation, that have the time orientation that you feel more in harmony with. You think that these kinds of people who are interested in social transformation will be an increasingly powerful force for that kind of transformation?
Yeah, I'm hoping so. I'm mildly optimistic. You have groups like the holistic health movement, the preventive health movement, the appropriate technology movements, alternative education, disarmament movements, some of the feminist thinking. There's a lot of movements that are just beginning to grope toward an ecological time frame. they're just beginning to sense, perhaps not even consciously, the idea that slow is humane. And I think that increasingly in the years ahead, the question of time values will be a major political issue, just like the question of spatial values were in the last decade. As I say, the myth of bigger is better has been challenged now by the idea that small is beautiful. And I think that in the years to come, the idea that faster is always better will be challenged with the idea that in some situations, slower is more humane and more compatible with social life.
That's Jeremy Rifkin. He was a guest on the show. Back then we called it Focus 580 in November of 1987. And we were talking about his book, Time Wars. Jeremy Rifkin is author of 17 books. They have been translated into 30 languages. He's president of the Foundation on Economic Trends. And since 1994, he's been a senior lecturer at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. This year, our program Focus turned 30. We've been celebrating by digging into our tape collection and bringing back some shows that are not part of our web archive. And in most cases, these are programs that have not been heard since they were first broadcast. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project. And you can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you'll find a place that you can leave a comment. You can also write to us at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. And the zip code is 61801.